Good evening. You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Once again, folks, make sure that you have pen and paper by your side, because once again, we're going to talk about something that you need to know and something that also some people are going to find extremely controversial. Be that as it may, we're still going to talk about it. I'm tired. We took the dogs up on top of the mountain today to run and play in the deep snow, and got stuck twice, and that's with a four-wheel drive vehicle. It was a lot of fun, and I worked my tail off getting out of there. So I'm a little bit sore and very tired. So I hope that'll take that into consideration if I make some mistakes tonight. We're going to be discussing British Israelism, known in this country as Christian identity. It is a racist doctrine that proclaims a master race descended from the house of David, actually farther back than that. They claim that they are the descendants of Seth, and that everybody else in the world are the descendants of Cain. And if you ain't one of them, you ain't nothing. You ain't nobody, and they don't want you around. Simple as that. They're racist in everything that they do and say, although if you ask them about it, they will tell you that they are racialist. And that they really don't have any objections to other races. They just don't want to live with them. And I'm here to tell you that's the biggest bunch of BS you ever heard in your life. If these people ever came to a position of real power, by real power I mean control, they would destroy anyone who doesn't believe as they believe, who doesn't look like they look, and isn't of their race. Now, I'm not just whistling Dixie here, folks. I've studied these people for a long time. I didn't even really know they existed until I started doing my radio broadcast. And all of a sudden I started getting pamphlets and books and letters of congratulations from these people who all thought for some reason that because I opposed the tyranny of those who would destroy this country, that I was somehow one of them. And when they found out that I was not, that I was part Native American, and that I was married to a Chinese woman, I got baskets full and bushels full and big boxes full of the most vicious, vile, despicable, uncouth hate mail that I ever imagined anyone could ever get in their entire life or that ever existed. I just simply did not know that this type of thing was going on. And they even attacked my wife and children for no reason at all other than they are who they are. And so I thought, gee, I better find out who these people are really quick because they're dangerous. They want to destroy my children simply because they're not pure Aryan. Now that made me very angry, and makes a lot of other people angry also. They claim that they are the true Israelites, Now, this is the strangest claim I've ever heard in my life, ladies and gentlemen, because I've never met one of these people who speaks Hebrew, who actually celebrates the actual Hebrew holidays that the Israelites practiced. They can't read Hebrew. And they mistranslate all the time. Of course, they mistranslate in their favor. But nevertheless, they mistranslate all the time. They'll take somebody else's translation and twist the meaning to mean what they want it to mean because they don't really understand the original Hebrew. They are descendants of Northern Europeans. Now, this is really easy to research, folks. Anybody can do it. You can go back and research the records of the Roman Empire when they went into Northern Europe, when they met the Celts and the Picts and the Gauls and the Teutonic tribes of Germany. These were not Hebrews, ladies and gentlemen. They were not the descendants of Hebrews at all. These were wild men. And I mean wild in every sense of the word. They went into battle stark naked, covered with clay. The Picts were famous for that. I could go on and on and on. They were steeped in nature worship. None of the original religious aspect of the Hebrews came into play with any of these tribes whatsoever. Another strange claim by these people, the British Israelites, is that they are the original progenitors, so to speak, the creators of civilization. Yet, in the Middle East, in Africa, and in Asia, there were great civilizations that existed long before these people ever even learned to put a loincloth on, much less become civilized. Their answer to that is that they descended from those Eastern and Middle Eastern civilizations and that they arrived in Northern Europe by some great circuitous route of migration. That doesn't wash either, ladies and gentlemen. If you study these people, you'll find that they most probably came, and I'm talking about the Northern Europeans, they most probably, according to scientists, but you can't really trust them either. You see, they say the American Indians came to North America across a land bridge from Siberia, and they're really Mongols who changed over a period of time and became North American Indians. What we call Indians, they're not Indians at all. They're just North Americans. But the American Indians say that that's not true. They have their own history. And they dispute that. And modern science has a way of changing its story through the years anyway. But they say that the Northern Europeans actually migrated from India. Now, I've been to India several times in my life, ladies and gentlemen. And I haven't seen anybody in the country of India, even in the highest caste groups, that resemble Northern Europeans. Sorry, but there just isn't anybody there who has that kind of resemblance. The ancient Hebrews did not look like Northern Europeans either. Another claim made by these people is that Adam, the father of the human race, and I can't understand why they make this sort of distinction, because Adam was the father of Seth and Cain. But they claim Cain was not produced by a union between Adam and Eve, but by a union between Eve and Satan. And they claim that Cain was the offspring of that union between Eve and Satan. It's all baloney, folks. It's the biggest crock of baloney that anybody's ever spouted ever in history. One of their explanations of this is that the true son of Adam was white, and that Adam actually means blood in the cheeks. When you research that word, you'll find that that's not what it means at all. They claim that Cain was actually a dark-skinned child born of the union between Eve and Satan. You know, there is... This really gets wild, folks. It really does. And when you research this name of Adam, you find that it means no such thing. It does not mean blood in the cheeks. And it comes from a long line of myths that existed long before the Bible was ever written, or the Jews became a nation, or the Hebrews became a nation known as Israel. And I'm just going to read to you a couple of short paragraphs from the Holy Grail by Malcolm Godwin, who himself is a British Israelist, but he tells the truth. And so that's what we're interested in this broadcast. He says, and I quote, "So far we have examined the historical bloodlines, but the blood which courses through the veins of the Grail myth carries with it the hint of something far more dangerous and powerful, like some dark magical ingredient which runs far deeper in ancient tunnels of the collective unconscious. We briefly glimpse the dark spring tides under the moon and the quickening of life. At the time when the Grail legends first appeared, it was generally accepted that the blood women spilled at the moon was responsible for new birth. They didn't know the biological functioning of the sexual organs or the process of the creation of a fetus in the womb. They had no idea at that time. So they believed that the blood women spilled at the moon, or their menstrual period, was responsible for new birth. Here's what he says about that. Blood which was retained in the womb was believed to coagulate into a child. Even Aristotle claimed that human life is a coagulum of menstrual blood. While the Roman Pliny, author of the Encyclopedia Natural History, insisted that it formed the material substance of generation. This curious notion was still taught in European medical schools only 200 years ago, ladies and gentlemen. Far earlier, the ancient Mesopotamian goddess Ninhursag was said to have created humankind out of clay mixed with her, quote, blood of life, end quote. The Jews, the Muslims, and the Christians borrowed this and similar creation myths to form their own. Now listen to this carefully. Remember, this person is a British Israelist. And he says, quote, "Even the name Adam can be traced to the feminine Adama, A-D-A-M-A-H, meaning bloody clay." So there you have it. And when you trace it back yourself, you'll find the same thing. Does not mean blood in the cheeks. Never did mean blood in the cheeks. Cannot mean blood in the cheeks. Now I'm going to give you the research of the Executive Intelligence Review, and this report is dated November 14, 1997. This is one of the best research organizations in the world, as far as I'm concerned. I don't particularly subscribe to their politics, but I do have great respect for their research, because I've duplicated it in almost every instance. I don't research everything they research, and they don't research everything that I have researched. But when we both research the same thing, the results are identical, which means these people are looking for the truth as I am, and they're not trying to put something in there that's not there. They tell it like it is. And so tonight, I'm going to tell it like it is. So take note of this. Make notes. Remember, listen to everyone, read everything, believe absolutely nothing unless you can prove it in your own research. Here we go. British Israelites and Empire. One of the most glaring examples of British intelligence-sponsored psychological warfare against the United States is the bizarre ideology called variously British Israelism or Christian Identity. Victims of this foreign-sponsored ideological virus can be found to hold key positions in the Patriot Movement and other movements which may be committed to the destruction of the American Republic. Not all Patriots are Christian Identity or British Israelism. And I can assure you that British Israelism and Christian Identity people who call themselves Patriots are not. They have no interest in restoring the Constitution for the United States of America, ladies and gentlemen. They want to split this country, and they want the Northwest four states, the four states in the northwest corner of the United States, as their own nation. So all of these people running around calling themselves patriots, who also believe in Christian Identity or British Israelism, are liars. They are lying to all of us. They have been linked, ladies and gentlemen, to the terrorist bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City in 1995. There are many links to that bombing at a city in eastern Oklahoma called Elohim City, which is a Christian Identity British Israelist community. And more broadly, a significant portion of what today claims to be Christianity in American society is consciously or unconsciously based on religious belief structures designed by the British Colonial Office to undermine Christianity in general and the American Republican form of government in specific. British Israelism is a syncretic organization which in its simplest variant claims that the Anglo-Saxon Celtic race is the true 10 lost tribes of Israel, that the British sovereign is descended from King David, and that as such, an all-encompassing British empire is biblically prophesied to rule the world in the few final days before Jesus Christ touches down on the Mount of Olives and ends human history. That's what they all want you to believe. None of it is true. They are not descended from King David. They are not Hebrews. They are not the 10 lost tribes of Israel. The tribes of Israel, folks, were never lost in the first place, in case you didn't know that. None of them were ever lost. The Bible does not say that they got lost. It's a scam. There are many variations on this theme. Some versions say that the horrors described in the book of Revelations have begun, and others believe that the tribulations are yet to come. Almost all, even the militant anti-Semites, looked to the Mideast, to Jerusalem, and yearned for the final rebuilding of Solomon's temple, which will be the incontrovertible sign that the end of the world is nigh. These people are also rabid Zionists, ladies and gentlemen. The roots of British Israelism are obscure, but some trace it to the late Elizabethan period in England, a time which coincided with the consolidation of the Church of England and the beginnings of Britain's maritime empire, as well as the creation of a full-time secret intelligence service. It's also the time, ladies and gentlemen, when the Royal House of England had to come up with some legitimate reason to oppose the Vatican and the Pope and pronounce their Anglican Church the real and only true church. And remember, there was no need for an Anglican Church until Henry VIII wanted to get a divorce, and the Pope said no. And that was the beginning of all of this. You see, all of a sudden, King Henry VIII told the Pope to go stick it where the sun don't shine. And he divorced his wife anyway under the Anglican Church. And you all know the the story of the opposition in England and what happened to them. And then the British monarchy had to justify all of their actions. And that's when all of a sudden, right then and there, they became descended from the house of David and possessed the only really divine right to rule. Now, how did this happen? Well, folks, sometime in the near future, they're going to say that they've uncovered historical evidence that Christ did not really die upon the cross, that he fathered children with Mary Magdalene. Those children, along with Joseph of Arimathea, Mary Magdalene, and the children, and the bones of Jesus Christ were taken from the Middle East to the British Isles, and blah, 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 blah. Under the throne of England, there is a stone which they claim is Jacob's pillar. Anyway, let me continue with this report. It might take two nights to cover this because there's a lot to talk about here. Remember, it's all baloney. None of it is true. One person who is reputed to have contributed to the early development of the British Israel ideology is John Dee, a fellow of Trinity College and advisor to Queen Elizabeth, who openly practiced black magic and prophecy. He was among the first to talk of England as an empire. Also, Sir Francis Drake, Elizabeth's favorite pirate, was notoriously partial to describing the fledgling empire of England as Israel and the New Jerusalem. You see, folks, if they can use these terms and convince the rabble, that's you, in case you didn't know that, the socialists call you the masses, if they can convince you that it's all true and you believe in the Bible, then you have to bow down to these people and let them rule you. You see, one of the first mind control operations. The beginning of the 17th century saw the rise of hundreds of cults across Europe. The majority of these, including what would later be known as British Israelism, can be traced to the efforts of Venice's top psychological warfare officer, Paolo Sarpi. Venetian strategic interests demanded that Europe be kept controlled and divided, and that the scientific breakthroughs of the Renaissance and the implication of those breakthroughs for the growth of human mental freedom had to be destroyed. You see, Venice had long learned that manipulation of religion is one of the most potent methods to control societies. Heck, the Pope had known that from the 3rd century, when the Emperor Constantine called the Council of Nicaea, and they sat down and determined what were going to be the books of the Bible and burned and destroyed and searched out and hid or completely obliterated everything that opposed what they chose to be in the Bible. There was no Bible before. There was a whole bunch of different books that all were written by different articles, authors that claimed to tell the real history of the religion. Not just the Christian religion, but all the other religions. And the Pope, over the years, combined the early teachings of Christ, the teachings of the early church, with all of the different pagan religions to create what is known today as modern Christianity. He even changed the day of worship from the seventh day, which is Saturday, ladies and gentlemen, to the first day, which is the venerable day of the sun, in order to pacify the sun worshipers and bring them under the control of the Catholic Church. Don't think so? Well, get your head out of the books that are written by those who want you to believe in them and start studying the real history of the world, and you'll find out that it's really true. Heck, the Pope even changed the Ten Commandments, which Moses claimed were handed down to him from God. Now, that's pretty arrogant, don't you think? Now, I'm not anti-Catholic. I'm just pro-truth. I don't care which religion you worship, as long as you do it in the light of truth. And if you choose to worship a mixture of truth and lies, or all truth, or something in between all of that, I don't care. But all you're ever going to get from me on this broadcast is the truth. I'll fight and die for your right to worship at whatever altar, whatever God you choose. because that's the only way I know I can have the freedom to worship at the altar and worship my God when and how I choose. You see, if I take your right away from you, I've also taken it from myself. But I've also learned over the years, ladies and gentlemen, that to live in a lie is to live a life already dead. And there is no such thing as choosing the lesser of two evils. Evil is evil. And if you choose evil, whether it's lesser or greater, you are living an evil life. I choose truth. And I hope you do too. See, these Venetian strategies and the interests of the rulers wanted Europe controlled. And they wanted the population divided amongst, or against, I should say, itself, just like today. And they foster and promote things that will divide people against each other. They didn't want the scientific breakthroughs of the Renaissance and any of the implications of those breakthroughs for the growth of human mental freedom to flourish. They had to be destroyed. These things were dangerous to those who ruled. Just like this broadcast is dangerous to those who rule today. What you're hearing on this broadcast, what you always hear on this broadcast, is the reason why William Jefferson Clinton, President of the United States of America, called me the most dangerous radio host in America. If you don't believe that, check around. Rush Limbaugh read it. It was written in a White House memo. Rush Limbaugh got a copy of it, read it on the air, right after the Oklahoma City bombing, in an effort to demonize me and vindicate himself. But whatever the reason, it was the greatest feather in my cap ever. It's a great compliment to me to have been so honored. Venice had long learned that manipulation of religion is one of the most potent methods to control societies. The Roman Empire knew it, used it. It's being used against you today, ladies and gentlemen. Venetian agents had a direct hand in the English King Henry VIII's break with Rome and in the creation of the Theocratic Church of England, or the Anglican Church. Venice, you see, was crucial to the transformation of Martin Luther's ill-formed movement into a Europe-wide Protestant schism, and Venice was equally pivotal in shaping the Vatican's countermeasures, thus ensuring decades of religious warfare. Martin Luther, whether you realize it or not, used the seal of the Rose and Cross on his correspondence. He was a member of the secret mystery religion known as the Rosicrucians. Within this Venetian onslaught, Paolo Sarpi's particular specialty was science. One of the greatest dangers to the oligarchical world outlook had arisen in the mid-15th century, when Nicolaus of Cusa, in effect, founded modern science and threatened to sweep away the mental straitjacket of Aristotelianism. Why do they have to make words? Why do they have to put an ism on Aristotle? Why can't they say the mental straitjacket of Aristotle? Sarpi's job was to repackage Aristotle's discredited method in seductive new ways. Sarpi's primary tool was what we today call empiricism, the insistence that science is not based on creativity, but is merely the discovery of the rules of nature, which we deduce from the facts which impinge upon our senses. Now, Aristotle wasn't a bad guy, and he wasn't discredited. Aristotle was the father of reason, ladies and gentlemen, in case you believe what the EIR said right there. As a skilled intelligence operator, Sarpi did not simply create one ideological package, but several, then, whichever one took hold could be further sponsored. Some cult variants were designed to appeal to scientists and had little to say about religion. Others were openly religious. Some flavored for Catholics, some for Protestants, and yet others were meant to draw in people who were confused about religion in general. Sarpi relied heavily on the ideas originally developed by Gnosticism. Of course, any Gnostic would, of course, ladies and gentlemen, say that Aristotle was wrong. Gnosticism is a cult of obscure Eastern origin which held that the universe, including the deity itself, was absolutely divided into spirit and the filthy degeneration of spirit called matter. A key belief of the Gnostics was that transcendence from the world of matter was dependent on secret knowledge. Gnosis means knowledge, which was attainable only by an elite of the sect who had achieved purity and had become born again out of the evil flesh. In other words, the hierarchy of the adepts known as the Illuminati. In the 11th and 12th centuries, Europe had seen large-scale Gnostic heresies, notably the Cathari, or Pure Ones, and their violent suppression. This Gnostic secret knowledge ideology is what Sarpi and his two famous collaborators, Galileo, Johannes Kepler. Under the Gnostic methodology, science explicitly becomes the same as alchemy, prophecy, or magic, which are all just a matter of hitting upon the right combination of chemicals, the right incantation, the plausible interpretation, or the illusion. This took many forms, including a few which contributed directly, ladies and gentlemen, to British Israelism. Francis Bacon, whom many classify as the founder of modern scientific method, explicitly saw science as nothing more than forcibly wresting from nature the secrets that God, a Gnostic deity containing good as well as evil, has maliciously refused to reveal. Bacon's text, The New Atlantis, which suggested that England could become the site of the new King Solomon's Temple, became the founding document of the British scientific espionage operation known as the Royal Society and the source of what is known as this country as America's secret destiny. It was here that Bacon coined the ominous phrase, quote, knowledge is power, end quote. This original Royal Society held alchemy and ghost hunting on the same scientific level as astronomy and chemistry. Another cult spun out of the Sarpi network, which contributes to many forms of British Israel, as well as to Freemasonry and Theosophy, is Rosicrucianism. Martin Luther was a member of that organization. Here again, the earliest origins are obscure and include unverifiable reference to the Crusading Knights Templar, officially the Poor Knights of the Temple of Solomon, and to various satanic cults. I can tell you absolutely that they can be traced right to the door of the Knights Templar. According to Masonic legend, a small group of Knights Templar escaped the Inquisition for the order's practice of the Eastern Baphomet cult, whose initiation rite involved spitting on the visage of Christ, to fight with King David Bruce at the Battle of Bannockburn in 1314, thereby engendering the origins of British Freemasonry and of Rosicrucianism. Within higher order Freemasonry, the degree of Rose Cross is known as the degree of revenge against the Pope and the French King. Thus, the Jacobinites of the Duke d'Orléans, Philip Eagleite, during the French Revolution, were known to be followers of Neo-Templarism. Don't go away, folks. We'll be right back after this very short pause while I sort of wet my whistle with a cup of water here. Remember, folks, if you're a search for a militia to join, if you find a militia that tells you that you have to be a Christian to be a member of that militia, it's not a militia, it's a religious army. The militia is defined by law. So, and we've given you that law many times on this broadcast. If you want to see it again, go to our website, harvest-trust.org. It's all there. Just go down to the thing that says militia on our homepage. Click it. The militia page will come up, and you'll have hours and hours of stuff to read and do there. Places to go. Things to look at. And I hope you do. I hope you've all been to our webpage at least once. You should visit as many times as you possibly can. I mean, you could literally stay on our webpage for weeks and not see and explore everything. That's how big it is. That's how good it is. It's a place for people who want to discover the truth. And here's the name again. All you need is http://harvest-trust.org. Head on out. Take a look at it. See what you think. And then leave a message on our Voices page, which is a forum where you can talk to other people who visit the webpage all across this country. Let me see here. Where was I? Shall endeavor to find my place. Here it is. Notwithstanding their primordial roots, the Rosicrucians' strict adherence to a system of esoteric secret knowledge made them grist for Sarpi's Gnostic mill. One of the few solid pieces of evidence we have about Rosicrucianism is that it was popularized in the early 17th century by a book by German theologian Johann Valentin Andrea titled Fama Fraternitatis. That's Fama Fraternitatis. Andrea's book described the fictional activities of one Christian Rosenkreutz, who after studying the magical theories of the East, returned to found a new society. Andrea's book was used as an organizing document by several of Bacon's more occult-oriented contemporaries, including Robert Flood and Sir Elias Ashmole, later the founder of speculative Freemasonry, with its first lodge in London in 1717. The introduction to Fama Fraternitatis is a reprint from the works of Traiano Boccalini, a Venetian theologian and a close friend of Sarpi. I believe that's Boccalini. I believe that's the correct pronunciation. Traiano Boccalini, a Venetian theologian and a close friend of Sarpi, and who also wrote La Balancia Politica, the first book in history to describe the need for a balance of power to rule Europe. At the same time, Sarpi's operations also encompassed several strictly religious ideologies. Venice had previously encouraged the most extreme Protestant forms, like Calvinism and its English variant, Puritanism, while simultaneously working to harden and militarize Catholicism against them. In the early 17th century, Sarpi's collaborators, like the oligarchical Sandys brothers in England and the legal theorist Hugo Grotius in Holland, began calling for a new religion, which would supposedly chart a third way between the extremes of Calvin's theocracy and the Vatican Jesuits. Typically, ladies and gentlemen, this new form would be based on Gnostic-style secret knowledge, the discovery of the original form, the Prisca Theologica, as they called it, of Christianity, before, as they claim, it was deformed by the early church, including St. Paul, and lost to man. Well, at least they're correct in that respect, folks. That's the truth. There is no church, organization, or group on the face of this earth today that calls itself Christian that actually practices what Christ taught and what the early first Christians believed and practiced. And that's the truth. I don't care what you call yourselves, and I don't care how mad this statement makes you, and I don't care how much you hate me for saying it, it is the truth. I was amazed because I was baptized in the Southern Baptist Church in Midwest City, Oklahoma, when I was, 13 years old, I believe. And I believed what they taught me and read the Bible and thought that it was all the way it was supposed to be. And I had been around to other churches, had been to many other religions, as a matter of fact, in my travels with my father as a boy. He was an Air Force officer, and for most of my boyhood, we lived in foreign countries. And so I got a good exposure to most of the religions of the world. I can remember when we lived in the Azores Islands, which are Portuguese. The maid used to take us on Sunday to the Catholic Church. And so I was exposed to these things. It wasn't until I really began researching the history of the world, and believe me, folks, I did not want to find what I found. I was not looking to prove myself or my religion wrong. Not at that time. Today I'm looking for the truth. I don't care what gets proven wrong because I've learned that most of us live our entire lives in a complete fantasy, in a complete deception of lies and manipulations without even knowing it, never looking to see if it's true or not. Most of us belong to the church we belong to simply because our parents did. Or, as a young and impressionable age, we were proselytized or recruited into it. And usually when we're recruited into it, we're not told the truth. We find that out sometime later. Very few people who belong to any church in this world today ever set out to study all the different religions and churches and theosophy and theology and mystical, or I should say mysticism, in order to find out which one is really telling the truth and which one is really the right one for them to belong to. It doesn't happen. Whatever church they end up in becomes the only right church with the only correct dogma and the only right message and the only path to heaven. Everybody else is going to hell. Isn't that the way it works? Isn't that the way it works, ladies and gentlemen? And of course, every preacher and every member of his church can pick Bible passages out of context to support whatever it is that they say is right. Without fail, they can all do that. See, I don't think that if the Bible is the inspired Word of God, that God would want it ever to be used in that manner, to tell you the truth. The writer Edwin Sandys even stated that this new religion should be an amalgamation of the Church of England, plus the kind of Catholicism then practiced in places like Venice. Much of the religious history of 17th century England can be characterized as various factions' attempts to decipher the secrets of the Bible and revive the, quote, old-time religion, end quote. Indeed, much of the original theology of such modern groups as the Quakers, the Pietists, and the Unitarians derives from these debates. And if anybody ever got close, it's the Quakers. This is a major reason why the Cromwellian Revolution of the mid-century saw intense public debates over biblical texts that might be used to proclaim that English law was in conformity with the laws of the Israelites and allow the Roundheads to claim that London was the new Jerusalem. Oliver Cromwell's offer to let the Jews return to England after centuries of exile, ladies and gentlemen, was not humanitarian. And Oliver Cromwell did not all of a sudden come up with some great love for Jews. It was made in the hope that the Jews could somehow reveal their biblical secrets and that somehow this action would give legitimacy to the claim of the royal house of England to be direct descendants of the house of David and the real Israel. John Milton's intense study of the Kabbalah and other Jewish esoteric texts was to the same end. And the Kabbalah, ladies and gentlemen, has become the basic tenet of the secret religion of all of the so-called secret fraternal orders and secret societies of the world. Even after the monarchy was restored in 1660, the debate merely intensified. Typical is Sir Isaac Newton, who was devoted to the search for Prisca Theologica, a Freemason in the tradition of Sir Elias Ashmole. Newton studied alchemy and corresponded with John Locke on the subject. Like Archbishop James Usher at the beginning of the century, Newton claimed to have divined the secret chronology of the Bible. In his book, The Chronology of Ancient Kingdoms, Newton presented a scheme for the rebuilding of Solomon's Temple. Many of Newton's last years were spent writing notes for a book of prophecy based on the revelation of St. John, in which he described the ultimate destruction of the Antichrist, by which he meant the Roman Pope. By Newton's time, England had not only taken over the oligarchy's imperial mantle from Venice, it had also become the cult center of the world. And just as Sarpi had planned, the corruption of the religious belief was vital to the corruption of scientific understanding. A very large reason why Newton's empiricist theories became so widespread was that they conformed to the new corrupt theologies. Indeed, the English clergy and their colleagues became Newton's greatest popularizers. The one person who fully understood this was the greatest scientist of his day, Gottfried Leibniz. When the Royal Society realized that they must use Newton to destroy Leibniz's influence and began an international defamation campaign, Leibniz responded in a famous series of letters to Newton's friend Dr. Samuel Clarke. And it is telling that Leibniz opened what was to be one of the great works of science with the line, quote, "natural religion itself seems to be declining in England," end quote. Understatement, don't you think? There are millions of Americans, ladies and gentlemen, who are now involved in Pentecostal, charismatic, and millennialist religious activity, including some who may be reading this right now. Having good feelings about those activities is not enough. That can be pure salesmanship. Simply knowing that your group is involved in good works is not enough. The New Testament warns against that kind of thinking. There are a lot of wolves in sheep's clothing these days demanding that you look beneath the surface and find out what are the core beliefs of your congregation. You may be shocked to find that your co-religionists have ideas which make it impossible for them to understand any kind of real research on this issue. Ask your minister or your priest or your friends and find out. Start a fight and do it intentionally, because that's how the truth comes out. Very quickly, you will see some lies flung out in defense. The single most important test is what your congregation believes about man being in the image of God. This point is often taken for granted because the Scripture tells us that God made man and woman in His image, and therefore, if you believe Scripture, you believe that. Not so. There's a lot of Protestant denominations that believe that Adam and Eve were made in the image of God, but that this image was hopelessly tarnished after their fall. Therefore, some say only the saved are truly in the image of God, and the rest of humanity are second-class souls. Now, this kind of thinking often afflicts the person who is loudly opposed to anything that would take a life before birth theoretically saving an elected soul, but who cannot muster much care for those lazy souls that God has apparently abandoned to their fate. And another important clue to what your congregation really believes can be found in their understanding of the role of reason in the worship of God. For instance, many people who call themselves fundamentalists become quite agitated at the mention of Philo, the Jewish philosopher of Alexandria, or the church father Augustine, the best-selling apocalyptics Hal Lindsey and John Walvoord have both written tracts against Philo because the Platonic philosopher proved that any attempt at scriptural prophecy was a narcissistic and impious attempt to make God conform to man's schedule. Scripture, said Philo, was a metaphor. And I've said it many times on this broadcast. It's true. Subject to a deepening interpretation as man grows in understanding. Augustine usually gets a blast for subscribing to Philo on this and related points. But what really perturbs the apocalyptics is Philo's and Augustine's absolute insistence that worship can never be irrational. As Philo beautifully puts it, God insists that his worshipers offer him only the first fruits. And for man, says Philo, that first fruits to be offered must be our creative reason. That's a sidebar written by Michael Minicino. Although the preconditions for British Israelism were rampant in England, the first formal statement of the ideology did not occur until the 1790s, when Richard Brothers, a Royal Navy officer who had fought against America in the Revolutionary War, began to write that England was not just theoretically the New Jerusalem, but that the English people themselves were descended from the lost tribes of Israel, and that they must restore the temple in Palestine. Now you see how it's transcended here? First the British people were just the British people. Then all of a sudden, when Henry VIII could not get a divorce, he broke from the Catholic Church and had to have a reason why his church could exist and was superior to the Pope. That reason was that the monarchy was descended from the House of David, and that England was, ladies and gentlemen, the actual 10 lost tribes of Israel, and London was the New Jerusalem. None of it true. Later, a British sea captain says that it is the English people themselves. Never mind that there was never any lost tribes of Israel. They can all be accounted for. Every one of them, folks. And he said that they must restore the temple in Palestine. The time for such theory was not ripe. Brothers was suspected of being a radical and was ultimately confined to an insane asylum. But his philosophy is exactly what has been adopted. And now it's not just the English people, ladies and gentlemen. It is the Aryan race comprising all the Anglo-Aryan peoples of the Northern European continent and all of those descended from those people who occupy the North American continent in the United States of America and Canada. So it's gone through three stages. But we're only at the second stage here in what we're studying. Oh, I bet there's some angry people out there. I bet they're really just seething. They don't like me. One night, ladies and gentlemen, here's my lineage. I'm English, Scotch, Irish, Native American. My wife is Chinese. My children are English, Scotch, Irish, Native American, and Chinese. Okay? I'm not Jewish. I'm not Hebrew. Never claimed to be. There's nobody in my family tree that we can find who is Hebrew or Jewish whatsoever. If I were, I would be just as proud of that as I am of being Native American, English, Scotch, and Irish. And I would be just as proud that my children would have that blood in them, because people are just people, folks, until they're sucked into these scams and manipulations and it's used to control them, and then they use it to control others, and then they become bad and evil people. You see? But one night, Pastor Pete Peters, one of the biggest leaders of the British Israelist movement in the United States and what's called a Christian identity, did a whole radio broadcast about how me and anyone else who criticized British Israelism in this country are Jews. And he even had a phone call from somebody who said that he had read my book, and in my book is a picture of my mother and father. He said, my mother and father look like Jews, therefore I must be a Jew, and they're Jews. Well, my mother and father don't look like Jews. There is a stereotyped image of Jewry. Some Jews fit that a little or a lot. Most Jews look like everybody else walking down the street, and you wouldn't be able to tell them apart, no matter if you had a divining rod and a crystal ball. That's the truth. But anyway, my mother and father don't fit that stereotype, neither do I. And most Jews don't either, ladies and gentlemen. The point is that these people are just absolutely rabid in the methods that they use to pull some anything out of thin air that will legitimize their position when they can't sit down and prove it with facts and argue it with reason. And so since I have been one of their greatest critics ever since I discovered who they were, when they sent me bushels of hate mail threatening to kill me and my wife and my children, labeling me as a race traitor, saying my children were mongrels and that they were fourth-rate animal people, and what do they call them? Mud people. Called my children mud people, and said that they should be exterminated, and they had no intelligence whatsoever. And every time I see these people, I see their children. It's amazing that my daughter could read when she was 3 years old. She's 7 now and reads better than most high school graduates, or excuse me, college graduates, I meant to say, and I mean that sincerely. And when I see these people, their excuse for not having their children already brought up to that level is that they're not old enough. Good night, folks. I just can't do this anymore. We'll continue where I left off tomorrow night, and we'll see what happens then, okay? Don't you think this is interesting? God bless each and every single one of you. Don't miss tomorrow night's broadcast. We've got a lot more to cover. We just barely scratched the surface, folks. That's the truth. One of the claims by British Israelites is that they're being exterminated through forced marriage to mud people, meaning, of course, other races. I've never seen that, have you? Listening to 101.1 FM Eager, classic radio like you always wished it could be.
Sagebrush everywhere, granite fires are standing all around. I tell you folks, it's heaven to be riding down the trail. When the desert sun goes down,
cactus plants are blooming.